KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
When we seriously engage in othering people, we actually diminish ourselves as well. So we may be more effective. And I know in politics, you have to be concerned about being effective, but we also have to be concerned about our humanity.
What this absurd political moment is really offering up is a very good example of when clinging to white supremacy has cost a white America, because equity could be greater for all of us.
In this program, racial justice innovators John A. Powell and Heather McGee show how empathy, honesty, and the recognition of our common humanity can change the story to bridge the racial divides, tearing humanity and the earth apart. This is Why Equity is Good for Everyone, changing the story, changing the world. I'm Neil Harvey. I'll be your host. Welcome to The Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature. George Lakoff, the author, cognitive activist, and professor of linguistics at the University of California, says this, quote, "One of the fundamental findings of cognitive science is that people think in terms of frames and metaphors, conceptual structures. The frames are in the synapses of our brains, physically present in the form of neural circuitry. When the facts don't fit the frames are kept and the facts ignored." Unquote. In other words, forget prevailing on the facts or the science, on reason. It's all about the story. Changing the story can change the world. How do we change the story of corrosive racial inequity? First, we have to understand the stories we tell ourselves, says Professor John A. Powell of UC Berkeley's Othering and Belonging Institute. He's an internationally recognized expert in the areas of civil rights, structural racism, housing, poverty, and democracy. He's the author of Racing to Justice, Transforming Our Concepts of Self and Other to Build an Inclusive Society. John A. Powell spoke at a Bioneers conference.
There are always multiple narratives, and those narratives are competing. And most of the time, we don't realize, and we don't talk about them in terms of narratives. So we live in stories. And most of the time, we live in stories unconsciously. So we don't think, this is my story. And what we're doing now, which is sort of interesting, we're consciously engaging stories. We're consciously engaging narratives. And narratives do a lot of things. They help us make sense of the world. They help us make meaning of the world. There are a lot of writing to suggest that people's experience doesn't belong to them until they can tell a story about it. There's actually research suggesting that children do not have a sense of self until they have a story about the self. Unfortunately, in the United States, the dominant story is about the individual, is about working hard, is about basically moving toward a meritocracy, and if you don't make it, it's your fault. And we just did some research with low-income people, white and black, which is interesting. And these are people who are really struggling. We found that whites were more likely to believe the story that if they weren't making it, it was their fault. Whereas the black poor was more economically almost exactly the same, but they were more likely to believe there's a flawed system.
In a culture of hyper-individualism, says John A. Powell, we're conditioned to take everything personally. It's our own doing, our own responsibility. Although personal responsibility can be a high virtue, All of us are operating within larger systems that we didn't create or choose, and that are often stacked to guide our narratives and behavior. But why would white people and black people hold such different perspectives on personal responsibility versus a rigged system? And equally important, who really benefits from that story and from that system? Heather McGee designs and promotes solutions to inequality in the U.S. She's the author of the book The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs and How We Can Prosper Together. Since 2002, she has helped build the nonpartisan think and do tank, DEMOS, that has had a profound influence on public policy, from landmark consumer protections to financial regulation, wage increases for low-paid workers, and democracy reforms. She says the story of personal responsibility for racial inequity is embedded in a deliberate campaign of misdirection. Heather McGee spoke at a Bioneers conference.
There's a paradigm that is ascendant right now, which is a zero-sum paradigm of racial competition, or gender competition, or national origin competition, or even urban-rural competition. And the idea there is that when my group does well, it's at the expense of your group. And if your group is doing well, it's at my expense. And that group competition is always sort of lateral. It's very rarely vertical. Of course, that is the underlying narrative in the white nationalist fear of demographic change. You will not replace us. Make America great again by changing, you know, who is in power in America. Make America great for white men again. All of that. The idea that is ascendant, and according to at least a couple of researchers, a majority idea that the most discrimination is now against white people, not people of color. So I think this is controversial, but it seems to me important in terms of the aspiration for the we. When progressives and radicals talk about white supremacy and white privilege, we say that racism is a benefit, a material and psychological benefit to white people, as much as it is a cost and a harm to people of color. And there's obviously a ton of economic evidence to show that, but if you think about it that way, it's pretty hard to actually unlock that logic. Racism is good for white people and bad for people of color. From the logic of the white nationalists that say that progress for people of color is bad for white people. And so I'm really interested in telling the many different stories that are there and have been there from the beginning of our country's history and all across the world of when white supremacy was materially and psychologically and emotionally harmful to white people. When patriarchy has been harmful to men. And there are so many examples, and it's just not one of the stories that we have felt an interest in sharing because there's so much pain and trauma. And we still have to fight to be heard that racism exists and that white privilege exists. And yet what this current moment, this absurd political moment, is really offering up is a very good example of when clinging to white supremacy has cost a white America because equity could be greater for all of us.
Heather McGee has long worked on issues around economic, racial, and political inequality. Some of her earlier work with DEMOS focused on the issue of personal debt. She says debt is a clear example of where shifting the narrative made pivotal differences in story and public policy. In particular, the campaign she directed redirected the notion of who the real culprit was in the crisis of rising personal debt.
When I started working at Demos on the issue of credit card debt, it was 2002. And over the course of the 1990s, the volume of credit card debt in the country had tripled, with the highest increase coming among low-income households and elderly households. And yet, this kind of crisis, it had topped $1 trillion for the first time. And of course, there were payday loans as well, and people using their mortgages as credit cards. This crisis of mounting debt was not seen as an economic issue. It was seen as a personal finance issue. Right? And so, you know, when we went and we did our media scan of the issue that we were going to work on, it was like all in the personal finance columns. And then there'd be some, you know, kind of USA Today regular type of story, but it was about like bankruptcy or something like that. And it was always the culprit, the responsible one, was the borrower. And of course, they weren't responsible, they were irresponsible. And the word irresponsible came up all the time. Debt is a serious and fascinating motif in our society and phenomenon. But when you're trying to think about an economic story that has villains and victims, it's a pretty powerful one. So long story short, we spent the next 7 years working very hard using research and storytelling to reframe the issue of debt among the people we decided had the power to do something about it, journalists and policymakers, particularly at the federal level. And so the shift we wanted to make that I think we were pretty successful at was from people borrowing for frivolous expenses. I remember it was like DVDs, which were new at the time, and sneakers was the coverage, to people borrowing for the little things in life, like healthcare and childcare and rent. And, you know, we did a big household survey to show this, right? Working in middle-class families, what are you putting on your credit cards? A carburetor, right? Prescription drugs. This was such a huge change, right? Tripled in the course of 10 years. We did need a culprit. And as it turned out, the deregulation of the credit card industry that had happened in the late 1970s, but really the practices changed in the late 1980s, had made it so that once you got into debt, it was nearly impossible to get out, and your volumes of your debt was just growing and growing and growing. So we were able to really shine a light on these tricks and traps, as our friend Elizabeth Warren says, and make the irresponsible people in this story, not the, you know, little old lady counting out her prescription drugs, but the Wells Fargo Bank and the Citibank that were making money hand over fist. And that switch was extremely important, and frankly, one of the most moralized, moralistic sort of economic terrains that we have, to paving the way for the Credit Card Act of 2009, which had a whole bunch of consumer protections that have saved borrowers over $50 billion in fees alone.
Who benefited from the tricks and traps of the personal debt crisis were the banks and credit card companies. The efforts of Heather McGee and Demos played a vital role in changing the story and led to policy and legal changes that saved people from the debt trap. Then again, the stories people hold are complicated, nuanced, and diverse. They turn on many factors, including their situation in life, race, gender, the media they consume, and their own psychology. So how do you break through the stories people hold to open the space to allow a different way of seeing? John A. Powell says it starts with acknowledging and respecting people's points of view. Then again, it doesn't end there. It's usually not so much an issue of bad apples as it is of a rotten apple barrel, the system itself.
Taking a knee. Is taking a knee about disrespecting the flag, or is it about respecting the flag and what this flag stands for in terms of equality and justice? Here's another one. Charlottesville, taking down the statue of Robert E. Lee. It's like, oh, you're taking down our history. Robert E. Lee was a traitor. He fought to disunite the United States. So people who are fighting to take down those statues should be wrapping themselves in the flag. We believe in the United States. There are a lot of people, who don't. Who's the villain? The people who don't believe in the United States. But this is the hard thing. There has to be a way for them back in. And so if there is someone who is culpable, it can't be that they're evil. And also, just as a factual thing, systems are complex. There are people who are deliberately doing things that are evil. People who would deliberately kill millions of people, who have to call it out. But most people are not in that space. Wells Fargo was the largest mortgage lender in the world. NAACP filed a suit against them. I negotiated with Wells Fargo. And we were coming out of a meeting. I was trying to get them to reset some loans and a bunch of things. When you securitize these things, you put them in trust. The law says you can't open it up, blah, blah, blah. And so I'm talking to these Wells Fargo guys, and I said, I don't know how to open it up, but you do. You can open it up. And they look at me like, how'd you know that? And then we walk out, and Ben Jealous says to me, John, I don't get it. You push these people really hard. You all but call them racist, and they like you. And I said, yeah. And I said, you know, and I like them, too. But I'm pushing them because we didn't do something. And I said, how do you feel about them? He said, I can't stand them. The point I'm making is that space where they felt, and they were trying, right? It's like, I work for Wells Fargo, I'm the vice president, I'm part of this, but I'm not an evil person. I'm sort of trapped too by these rules, by the laws, by the whatever, and I'm saying, you can push. So I guess what I'm always saying is that if the villain is personalized, we have to be extremely careful and provide a way back into the circle of human concern. When we seriously engage in othering people, we actually diminish ourselves as well. So we may be more effective. And I know in politics, you have to be concerned about being effective, but we also have to be concerned about our humanity.
When we return, more from John A. Powell and Heather McGee on how empathy, listening, and respect can liberate everyone, and how changing the story leads to a vertical climb to systemic change. In other words, don't take it too personally. This is Why Equity is Good for Everyone, Changing the Story, Changing the World, on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature. You can explore more Bioneers radio programs, podcasts, and videos online and learn about the National Bioneers Conference at bioneers.org or call 1-877-BIONEER. Imagine for a moment trying to connect with someone coming from a radically different and offensive point of view. Then add racial prejudice to the mix. Then air the surprise interaction live on national TV. That's what Heather McGee faced on C-SPAN in 2016 during the height of the racially charged Trump campaign.
I'm on the show, and halfway through, I get a call from a guy who identifies himself as Gary from North Carolina.
Yeah, good morning. I was hoping that your guest can help me change my mind about some things. I'm a white male, and I am prejudiced. And the reason it is something I wasn't taught, but it's kind of something that I learned. When I open up the papers, I get very discouraged at what young black males are doing to each other and the crime rate. And I understand that, and it's a deep issue that goes beyond that. But when...
You know, so I'm listening, and again, it's like a close-up of my face as I'm hearing this, right? So I'm like... Then he says, but I want to change. And I want to know what your guest can do to help me become a better American. So, you know, my heart's like in my throat. This is all live television. And this like really kind of snarky host was like, Heather? You don't really have time to think in this moment. So I said the first thing that came to my mind, which was thank you. Thank you for being honest. Because being honest about your bias is one of the most powerful things that you can do in this moment. And then I went on to, very much off the top of my head, give him some ideas about what he could do to basically de-bias his life, to integrate his life.
So what can you do? Get to know Black families who are not all, not even any majority, are involved in crime and gangs. Turn off the news at night, because we know that actually nightly news and many media markets that have been studied actually overrepresents African-American crime and underrepresents crimes that happen by white people.
Read about the history of African-Americans in this country. I could tell he had like a white-black paradigm going. Foster conversation in your community about these issues. And then that was it, right? Because then it goes on to the next caller. And I, you know, went on to the next call and stepped off the set. And one of my coworkers in our communications team said, you know, that was a really powerful exchange. We should put it on Facebook. I said, yeah, sure. And so it went on Facebook on Saturday. And by Monday, it had 1 million views. And Demos' social media is like charts and graphs, and it does not usually get 1 million views, but this one did. It just had this life of its own. And then there were articles about it in local news stories, and it was just one of those like positive stories that just people just couldn't get enough of it, because this was this was August of the Trump campaign summer, right? And this, you know, Donald Trump is coming down those golden stairs and saying Mexicans are rapists and criminals, and then saying, I'm not a racist. And here was this sort of white everyman saying, I'm prejudiced and I want to change. And then I, a Black woman on TV, that's how I was identified, Black woman gives amazing answer to racist caller. You know, and I didn't bite his head off, right? I wasn't an angry Black woman. I spoke with empathy that I honestly felt, right? It wasn't an act. But so, long story short, I will tell you the end of this story, which is that Gary from North Carolina went on Twitter to find me, because this is, you know, it was like in his local newspaper now, this story about the, you know, prejudiced guy from North Carolina. I just have this image of him like opening up his paper and like spitting out his cereal. And so he calls me and he says, this is about a week later, he says, you know, I went to a Black church on Sunday. And I went to the bookstore and I got all these African American studies books, and I told the girl at the checkout that I was trying to become less prejudiced. And he has actually gone on what he calls this walk. And I know Gary now. I've met him. I've hung out with him probably half a dozen times over the course of the past 18 months. And I can honestly consider him a friend. And it's pretty amazing to see how much a moment of empathy can just be an invitation. He's done all the work. Like, I'm not saving this guy. I have other things to do. But it was an invitation, and he answered it, and it was just the right moment, the right time in his life, and he's now really committed to being an anti-racist and to bringing other people along.
But unlike Gary, not all such interactions take place in a space of honesty, empathy, and openness. How do you create a basis to find common ground when people's viewpoints and stories are closed and hostile? Again, John A. Powell.
I was asked to go down and speak in Alabama to a bunch of community folks who were had questions about the Affordable Care Act. There was 300 people in the room, all white, I think all Republican, almost all working class. And before I went out to talk to them, my host said, we should tell you, we had someone coming in last week to talk about some of these same issues about the Affordable Care Act and race, and they got booed off the stage. So good luck. So I went out there. Again, people were completely closed, and I was talking about the Affordable Care Act and race. And I started asking a series of questions. I said, how many of you in the audience, this sort of stand up, if someone in your family lost their insurance because they lost their job. Some people stood up and said, just keep standing. And how many of you had some procedure denied because the insurance company, after your doctor prescribed it, said they weren't going to pay for it? That's like two more questions. By now, everybody's standing up, right? And I said, how does that make you feel? They use a lot of colorful words. And I said, the insurance company shouldn't be deciding your life. And that's what the Affordable Care Act is trying to fix. Yeah, as bad as it is in your community, it's worse in the Black and Latino community. I didn't lose one person. So part of what I did in terms of empathetic listening and engagement is I got their suffering into the conversation.
At the same time, says John A. Powell, establishing a respectful personal connection can be the first step toward that vertical view.
After the four or five police got killed, I think in Dallas someplace, I was walking in New York, 6 o'clock at night, it was dusk, and there were these four burly policemen in New York, they're just chatting each other up, and I see them and I start walking over toward them. There are people milling around, it's in Union Square. As I get close to them, the chatting starts slowing down, and then pretty soon, all eyes are fixed on me. And here's this, you know, old Black man walking up against these four white guys with guns and billy club and radios. It's like, and they're afraid. I mean, they clearly are afraid. And I walk up to him and I say, oh, good evening. I just want to say I really appreciate you trying to keep us safe. We had a conversation then. And literally one guy says, so who are you anyway? And I said, do you have a car? Do you ever come to New York? Now, in that moment, right, I had recognized their humanity. But it's just not horizontal. Their relationship with the community is vertical. Mm-hmm. They wanted their humanity acknowledged, but they're still in a vertical position. And so part of it has to become part of the story. And I do a lot of work with police departments, and one of the flaws is, how do you help the police become better people? Maybe, you know, that's always a good goal, but they're in a system that's incredibly corrupt. And you put a Black police in that system, a white police in that system, a woman in that system, and they get corrupted by the system. So part of it is really to make the system itself support our collective belonging. We can't do all the work at the interpersonal level. And we have systems and structures that make it almost impossible for us to see each other as human beings. And there's a lot of stuff we can build on, and stories that we can tell, and narratives. But unless we also tell a narrative about the system, and how the system is tearing us apart, even as we try to be together, I think we can't build a circle where we all belong.
John A. Powell and Heather McGee. Why Equity is Good for Everyone. Changing the Story, Changing the World. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the presenters and are not necessarily those of Collective Heritage Institute, the underwriters, or this radio station. Executive producer, Kenny Ossibel. Written by Kenny Ossibel. Senior producer and station relations, Stephanie Welch. Host and consulting producer, Neil Harvey. Producer, Teo Grossman. Program engineer and music supervisor, Emily Harris. My name is Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. This is program number 241.
This program was made possible in part by Guayaki Yerba Mate, working with indigenous farmers in South America to grow shade-grown organic yerba mate to inspire us all to come to life. Learn more about Guayaki's products and regenerative mission at guayaki.com.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
It would never have occurred to my parents that one day they would get to meet the British royal family. Yet that's what did happen 80 years ago, in the summer of 1945, at an event to mark victory over Germany in World War II. My parents were both from the south of Ireland, my father from County Clare, my mother from Dublin, but they had separately gone to work with what was then the National Bank, and had been moved to various parts of the island before and after they met and married in Belfast. On the night of the German Blitz on Belfast in April 1941, that's where our family was living. I was nearly 4, my sister was 9, and my brother just 1 year old. 1,000 people were killed in the city that night. A house 2 doors away from ours took a direct hit. We survived, but our home would not be livable. My mother, my brother, and myself caught an overcrowded morning train to neutral Dublin, where we stayed with her parents. My father found a temporary flat with my sister in Belfast. We were all reunited when he was promoted to be a bank manager, first in County Leitrim and then in Derry. I was aware that the war was still going on, but I was too young to know that the sailors I could see in the city streets, including many Americans, and thousands like them, were involved in the vital Battle of the Atlantic, which the Allies eventually won at huge cost in vessels and human lives. The war with Germany ended in May 1945. A few months later, my father was to take a decision as bank manager which offended some of its nationalist customers. As part of a royal victory tour of the UK, the King and Queen and the then Princess Elizabeth paid a visit to Northern Ireland. The visit included Derry, where the Lochfoyle naval base had been hugely important. My father was among a group of local professional and business people who were invited to a garden party in Brook Park. He had no hesitation in accepting the invitation and went there with my mother, even though many nationalists saw the occasion as a paying tribute to a monarchy they resented. As he told me later, the invitation had been an honour for the bank, and he was the bank's representative. However, that a man with his personal history should find himself meeting royals face to face was indeed extraordinary. 25 years earlier, on an infamous November Sunday in Dublin, he had been one of many thousands of spectators in Croke Park who had come to see a Gaelic football match between Dublin and Tipperary. But that afternoon, on what became known as Bloody Sunday, armed British units of black and tans, auxiliaries and police opened fire on spectators and players. 7 people, one of them a player, were killed. 5 more died of their wounds, and 2 were trampled to death in the panic to escape. "I was knocked over in the stampede," said my father, "but I was young and fit. I reckon I was safer on the ground with my hands over my head than on my feet as a target." I was 10 years old when he talked to me about it. His account was brief, vivid, shocking. But his summing up was neither a political message nor a generalization about the British. There are times when people do very bad things. So, somehow it happened that a survivor of Ireland's first so-called Bloody Sunday came face to face with the British royal family in Derry, a city that was to suffer its own Bloody Sunday in the Troubles a few decades later. My mother, who was with him at the Derry garden party, had had her own encounter with black and tans when she was a 10-year-old child in Dublin. One morning, when her parents were out and she was in charge of younger ones, there was a hammering on the front door. The children were confronted by a group of armed men. The officer in charge demanded to see their uncle, who was a university student lodging with the family. When my mother said he wasn't at home, he demanded to be shown his room. Then came a bizarre twist in the story. While his men clattered past them, the officer escorted the anxious children into the living room and sat down at the piano. He played what he called music hall tunes, unknown to his young audience, and he kept playing amid clumping noises from upstairs. Nothing was found then or later to link their student uncle with anti-British activities, and he eventually became a Harley Street consultant in London. But what stayed most vivid in my mother's memory was not the black and tans invasion of her home, an all too common experience for Dubliners at that time, but the decency of one officer who made an effort to comfort frightened children.
For the best part of 10 years, I drove a 35-minute commute to my job at the Swiss Broadcasting Corporation. I joined the Autoroute near my home in French-speaking Fribourg, which soon became the Autobahn in German-speaking Bern. Driving towards Bern when the timing was right, I witnessed the splendor of the sun rising over the Alps. And on my return journey in the evening, I would race the setting sun. At 120 kilometers per hour, I passed forests and hills, undulating farmland, rivers and streams, always in my peripheral vision, remaining unknown. But by the time I left the job, an idea had taken hold in my mind. I wanted to walk my commute. Hiking is sacred in Switzerland. You can walk from any point to any point without ever having to worry about right of way. The country is crisscrossed by 65,000 kilometers of signposted laneways and pathways across all kinds of terrain. On a Saturday morning in May, I set out from home in my brand new hiking boots. I walked uphill towards the forest on the far side of our housing estate. Turning my back on civilization, I walked into the woods and the promise of solitude. Almost one third of the country is covered by forest. Having grown up by the Irish Sea, this is a new world to me, a beautiful, mystical world with ever-changing light and sounds. I had my route printed out on 10 A4 pages. Every page was about an hour's walk, I discovered. The day was dry, the sun never far away, and the route full of variety. I ate a sandwich on a bench overlooking a field of barley in Heitenried at around 12 o'clock. I crossed the River Sense by the covered bridge at Sodbach. The first half of the walk went smoothly, and it was only a quarter past two when I got to the small town of Schwarzenburg, where I had planned to spend the night. I went to a cafe, ordered a beer, and studied my maps. My boots were bothering me a little bit, but a few plasters were keeping things under control, and I felt fit and well. How hard could it be to do another 18 kilometres? There was only one way to find out. So I cancelled the B&B and walked out of town, up another hill and into another forest. When I wasn't on forest or river trails, I was walking along the edges of fields of corn, wheat, potatoes and turnips. Suspicious cows and sheep watched me go by, not approving of my presence. It made a nice change from cars and trucks. The wooden farmhouses I passed were hundreds of years old, in the local vernacular style, with deep eaves and roof shingles. The barn and living quarters were housed under one roof, with a ramp leading up to the hayloft, so a cart could drive straight up. Though the style has been refined over the centuries, it has essentially stayed the same since the 1300s. Every house had its orchards, its showcase vegetable garden. That continuity and the relative peace that came with it is the essential difference between Swiss and Irish landscape. The Swiss relationship with their land is one of stability and harmony. There is none of the trauma that lies under the surface in the Irish countryside. No whispers from the ghosts of the dispossessed. Things took a turn for the worse at Schwarzwasserbrücke, a railway stop on a provincial line. Another break, this time in the back garden of an enormous old guest house, the only building at the stop. I finished my tea and crisps and stood up to leave. While I'd been sending texts and double-checking the maps, my body had decided this was the moment to mount a serious protest. Everything from my lower back down was stiff and aching, the pain in my feet almost unbearable. Bent over and wincing, I hobbled out onto the road. I looked longingly at the station platform, but turned to carry on. If all went well, I would reach my destination, my old workplace, in 2 hours. Impossible to stop now. I trudged on for another 2.5 hours, muscles and blisters hurting at every step. But my pace had slowed and I never did make it to the office. When I reached the outskirts of Bern, I saw a city bus and I realized the game was up. I bought a ticket from the machine, the best 2 francs I ever spent. Later, I sat at the bus terminal in the suburb of Könitz, with the last rays of sun keeping me warm until my lift arrived. I didn't mind that I hadn't completed my mission to the letter. It was the spirit of the thing. I had paid homage to the land and tested myself. I was ready to move on.
You keep saying you got something for me. Something you call love, but confess. You've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin'.
On a spring morning, arriving early to avoid the crowds, a young Dutch couple enters the Richelieu wing of the Louvre Museum. Martin, a baby-faced 20-year-old, is hopelessly overdressed. His wife, Opian, 2 years older, struggles to hide a smile at his flashy attire. This journey is not their honeymoon, or even their anniversary. By now, they have been married for nearly 400 years. Martin and Opian, or rather Rembrandt's full-length portraits of Martin and Opian, have come to Paris because they have been jointly acquired in a unique collaboration between the Dutch and French governments. Speaking on Dutch Radio 1, the director of the Rijksmuseum, Wim Piebs, likens the paintings to a pair of shoes, never to be separated. For years, the portraits of Martin Solmans and Opian Coppet had hung together in the bedroom of Baron Eric de Rothschild. When the Baron finally decided to sell, both the Louvre and the Rijksmuseum balked at the asking price, a mere 80 million euro apiece. The solution? The Rijksmuseum purchased Martin, the Louvre, Opian. There was one stipulation: the paintings must always be exhibited together. And so began a new partnership. After enduring the necessary indignity of restoration, Martin and Opian would spend 5 years together in Amsterdam, the next 5 in Paris, and forever travel back and forth between the two cities, a lifestyle befitting the high-status couple they once were. At the time Rembrandt painted these portraits, his own love story was unfolding. In 1634, he married Saskia von Ulleberg. He was a miller's son, she a burgomaster's daughter. Despite the disparity in social standing, the marriage appears to have been a happy one. What can the artist have thought of his rich young sitters with their trendy lace collars and glitzy accessories? It's tempting to imagine he must have painted Martin's flounces and Opian's artificial mole or mouche with his tongue held firmly in his cheek. Martin's pose is filled with swagger. One hand rests on his hip, conveniently affording us an excellent view of his expensive black cloak. His white collar reaches below his shoulders and is mirrored by the extravagant ruffles on his garters. Most marvellous of all are his shoes. He treats us to a full frontal of one foot, a side profile of the other. Sumptuous rosettes the size of dinner plates adorn the buckles. The sheen of polished black leather is set off by silver-grey stockings encasing a pair of well-formed calves. He seems unembarrassed by the height of his heels. Opian turns towards Martin, 1 foot forward, as though she is about to step out of her frame to join him. She holds her ostrich fan at the ready, should she need to hide her blushes at her husband's ostentation. Her collar, her black dress, form a kind of symmetry with his outfit. But the subtle lustre of her pearls, the dignity of her poise to me convey class as well as wealth. The shoe, half visible beneath her skirts, is made of grey leather and adorned with a rosette a fraction the size of her husband's. If Martin's footwear speaks loudly of new money, Opium's more modest choice could perhaps be seen to emphasise her noble lineage. Martin Solmans was the son of a Belgian immigrant who owned a sugar refinery in Amsterdam. The sugar trade at the time was notoriously dependent on slave labour. On Dutch-owned plantations in Brazil, the native Tupi people were routinely exploited and abused. After 8 years of marriage, Martin died, and Opium assumed his share in the refinery. 5 years later, she took a second husband, Martin Day, a man who had spent time in the colonies where he was known for his sadistic behaviour. Opium performed administrative duties for him throughout their marriage, so surely must have known all about the disturbing source of their shared wealth. The fashionable young couple settling into their new home in the Louvre know nothing of the tumultuous life events to come. For them, time stopped on the day Rembrandt painted their portraits. In the intervening centuries, they have never been parted. And now their future is assured. Thanks to the intervention of a Dutch Prime Minister and a French President, this pair of shoes will always stay together.
Most days in Limerick, my temporary and beloved home, I was inside gray skies, a grid of buildings, and strangers under hoods and umbrellas who could be friends, but were not yet. We rushed by in our haste to get warm and dry, to get food and drink, to get drunk and flirt with someone, anyone. I also lived across the street from the Shannon River, so wandered the boardwalk with a vagabond's hope for a heron or swan to claim me, swooping me up across the water. The Shannon is a tidal river, surging at 4 knots on the ebb. High tides can reach 17 feet under a full moon and high winds. I tracked its rise and fall, and its current, quiet or quick, and understood in my river-keeping, time was a current. But this current was more than a metaphor. People lost and at their ends, booze, drugs, unemployment, heartbreak, and feeling forgotten in this post-Celtic tiger Ireland. Men, and mostly young, took their own lives in the Shannon. 2 men in 1 month, right in front of my house. My landlady explained that for a few years, right after the 2008 crash, it was particularly bad. "It's gotten better," she said. "Not as many, not as often. But what is better when it comes to suicide?" One morning, while I was drinking tea in bed, still holding onto the night's warmth, a helicopter churned loud and low over the river. Boats and fire trucks raced into view. News flashed on my feed. Emergency services have been deployed to a river rescue following the report of an individual entering the River Shannon this morning. I watched at the window, hands pressed to the cold pane, and remembered, as I prayed, a long-ago November night in college when I jumped into a half-frozen lake and was saved by campus security. How I swam away from their dinghy, how I fought their hands and kindness, how I longed to disappear underwater, to stay alone in my aloneness, how a burly officer dove in and hooked his arm around my neck as if catching the saddest angriest sea monster. No, I said. No, no, no. Yes, he said. Yes, yes, yes. When we reached shore, I shivered with a sudden tooth-chattering violence, but felt, too, how I was being returned to the world. I remember the moon, so bright and distant in that dark sky, and the officer whispering, "We'll get you warm. Help is coming." And the odd flash of recognition when I walked alone at night along the Shannon, a keening toward that old despair. How easy to jump into that current. I searched instead for the swans paddling in the moonlight, as if my searching for them mattered. One late night, I walked around the river, crossing over its bridges, circling the dark, circling my ordinary loneliness, circling my way to compromise. Keep moving, don't stop. Keep moving, don't stop. I leaned against the river railing and watched a swan paddle through the dark water. Ghost bird. A man and woman on bicycles and wearing bright yellow vests pedaled up and stopped. Quiet, gentle smiles. The Limerick Suicide Watch. "How's your evening?" the man asked. "Grand," I said. "Just watching the swans." "You okay out here by yourself?" the woman asked. "Oh," I said, "just walking." The answer was no, and the answer was yes, and I knew I'd keep walking and would be in bed soon, would not be in the river, because I could see that was what they feared, because the man was searching my face, and the woman seemed to be watching my hands that gripped the railing. "It's just that we noticed you've been walking around the river for a while now, so," the man said. How many people had they missed? How many people had they found who might have been thinking, "This, this, this, now, now, now"? And how many had they saved? And could I be the counterweight to the many they had not? I saw their worry and decided not to worry them unnecessarily. "Thank you," I said. "It's a lovely night. No rain. But now I'm on my way back home to bed." They smiled, waiting on their bikes, and I saw they were hoping I'd walk on, and so I did.
In this proud land we grew up strong. We were wanted all along.
It seems strange to think of it now, but when I was a student in Trinity in the early 1950s, very few people travelled abroad. So it caused some surprise when I decided to take a trip to Germany on my motorbike, a Royal Enfield 350. To travel to Germany as a civilian, so close to the end of the war, required visas, and identification was frequently asked for. Several letters had to be sent out to various German universities, in particular to the chairman of the German Amateur Athletic Association. He then kindly invited me to stay as a thank you for acting as the team's interpreter after I had run against Germany's 400-meter champion. What to take for a six-week trip in my two pannier bags and a rucksack? No crash helmet, as they didn't exist, but a pair of Mark 6 ex-Air Force goggles and a rainproof boiler suit for when it was wet. I felt like an explorer about to penetrate the great unknown. I knew that I would have enough to eat for 3 days, as my mother had prepared 3 different lots of sandwiches, all wrapped in lettuce leaves to keep them fresh. I sailed from Belfast to Hesham and thence to Harwich to spend my first night in an old-fashioned railway hotel. Up early next day to catch the ferry to the Hook of Holland, and then I was on my way. My first shock was a small Dutch town near the German border, where I hoped to get some petrol. I rode all around it and saw nobody. The entire town was in ruins, with not one building left standing. I soon noticed that wherever I went, my motorbike was the subject of much admiration, primarily because it was one of the first after the war to have a chrome finish, and seen in Germany, where I had expected to see far greater modernity. Travel on the autobahns was mostly large juggernauts with two trailers. But what surprised me most was how primitive many of the smaller towns were. There was cow dung on the roads, very few cars or trucks, and most of the tradesmen using four-wheel drays. On the street, people wore somber expressions as they made their way through the debris of the towns. Not that I could blame them. It was to be another 2 years before Erhard, the German Wirtschaftswunder, managed to revivify and rebuild the German coal and steel industries. I drove on through the Black Forest to the city of Finningen, and then on to Iserlohn, where I was taken to a big athletics conference and dinner, and presented with a pair of the latest Adidas spikes. On to Minster, where I saw a superb outdoor performance of The White Horse Inn, a musical comedy. After the performance, about 80% of the audience left, leaving behind about 100 men who rose with their crutches and single remaining legs. At that moment, I understood completely why my father had always refused to speak about his experiences in the trenches during World War I. Coming to Karlsruhe, I had to cross the Rhine by ferry, as the bridge hadn't yet been rebuilt. I got chatting to the ferryman en route when he admired my motorbike. I then discovered, to my amazement, that he had been second in command of the U-boat which had dropped Sir Roger Casement off the Kerry coast in 1916. Ever onwards towards a small four-bedroom village in Unterkirnach. There I met another guest who told me that she and her two sisters had all lost their husbands just 3 weeks before the end of the war. I was now in the French zone, the area allocated to the control of the French following Germany's collapse. Not unreasonably, having lived under the iron and fearsome rule of the Gestapo, the French made life for the German citizenry as difficult and distasteful as possible. The exception were doctors, who would be held in high regard as their clients often included French soldiers. The following day I met the local doctor, Hans, and his wife, Bethle. She had worked with him as a nurse on the Russian front. Hans and Bethle had been working under the most appalling conditions, often for 15 hours a day. Operations were frequently performed without drugs, and the screams of the wounded were the perpetual background to their work. Hans had returned home to find that his first wife and two of his children had been killed in an air raid, and the house totally destroyed. Soon after, he and Bethle married, essentially so she could care for his remaining children. Hans was in his 50s, and she in her 20s. But situations like this were by no means unusual after the war, where marriages were often a result of practical need. Beitla herself was lovely to look at. Her eyes expressed her emotions, and even today I can still feel their warmth. It sounds extraordinary to say so, but it was love at first sight.